For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. The second round of negotiations on Britain's exit from the European Union is underway in Brussels. This round will last until Thursday, and officials on both sides have until March 2019 to hammer out a deal. Jack Parrock reports from Brussels.
The initial discussions are focusing on the rights of EU citizens living in the UK, the amount the UK is expected to pay in prior financial commitments to the EU, and the border between Northern and the Republic of Ireland. The EU says until those issues are resolved, there will be no talks about a future trade deal. And Brussels currently says that the UK's offer on citizens' rights is nowhere near good enough. Brexit talks resume off the back of a weekend of major divisions between UK government ministers, with Brexit Secretary David Davis believed to be being urged to stage a leadership challenge against Prime Minister Theresa May. He's said to be coming to Brussels for the negotiations with a spy-proof briefcase, which means his computer and phone can't be hacked. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
South Korea is proposing military talks with North Korea. They would be the first high-level talks since 2015. The suggestion from Seoul comes after heightened tension over Pyongyang's missile testing. The EU plans to expand its security and defence role. EU foreign affairs ministers will discuss increased sanctions against Syria over its chemical weapons. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson wants new measures against senior military officers. At a Foreign Affairs Council in Brussels, ministers plan to extend Operation Sophia, a search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean, as Jasmine Ramirez reports.
The Mediterranean route between Libya and Italy is extremely dangerous. Deaths rose by 42% from 2015 to 2016. The council will look to extend Operation Sophia to continue saving migrant lives and disrupt the operations of human traffickers. Foreign Affairs ministers will also discuss sending a security and defense team to advise the Iraq government on its security services after the fall of Mosul. Ministers will discuss more sanctions against Syria with their recent series of chemical weapon attacks. The EU also looks to expand sanctions against North Korea after the country's latest ballistic missile test.
Scientists have discovered millions of tons of precious metals and minerals in Indian waters. The presence of the seabed treasure trove is scattered across areas off Chennai in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. Rebecca Bundon reports from Mumbai.
Scientists at the Geological Survey of India have identified millions of tons of marine resources. These include phosphate sediment off the coast of Chennai and gas hydrate off Tamil Nadu, according to the Times of India newspaper. The deposits that geologists came across indicate that more resources could be unearthed with more extensive exploration, the report says. The geologists used high-resolution seabed mapping and state-of-the-art vessels to explore India's waters.
For bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ali Barrett, and good evening to you. It's great to be back. Only missed a couple of shows, really. Make up for that later in the week. Internet messing around in our neighbourhood is over for good. No more telecoms companies here. To be honest, we got away with it, really. From what I understand, there's been issues all over the place with people losing service. Anyway, it's all done now. This is Monday, the 17th of July, 2017. How are you?
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's the Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
George Galloway joins us this hour. Not much I can tell you about George that you don't know. Former MP, of course. Makes television and radio shows now for Talk Radio and for RT, as well as making documentary films like The Killings of Tony Blair. I'll be asking George if he thinks Brexit will ever happen. Just how influential behind the scenes to stopping Brexit is Tony Blair? We'll talk to George this hour. And in the second hour, due to be on with me last week, the wonderful Peter Robbins joins this programme for the first time. I'm delighted to welcome him to the programme. You'll know a lot about Peter if you're into ufology, UFO studies, because he's written books, he's lectured all over the world, he's an investigator, an activist, and much more besides. Peter Robbins joins this programme in the second hour. And as I've not spoken with Peter before, it'll be a kind of a personality interview. We'll get to know Peter, find out what motivates him, how he got into ufology, and where his studies have taken him over the years. I think that's going to be good. And I'm looking forward to your company as well. Thank you for joining me. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter, richie@richieallen.co.uk. And welcome back, Simon Stewart, the great Simon Stewart, my great friend in Birmingham, who has had his own internet issues over the last few weeks, but is back, and he'll be looking after the uploading of this programme to YouTube from here on in. Again, great that Simon is back. To our little team of three. Before I go anywhere, we're live on davidicke.com. Bookmark davidicke.com/headlines. And I want to say a massive well done to Jamie Icke, who on Saturday night, I couldn't make it because of other commitments, but on Saturday evening in Derby, Jamie took part in one of these white collar boxing events where you train for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then you get into the ring with somebody else who's trained, none of you having any boxing experience, and you have at it for three rounds. It takes an enormous amount of courage. So big up to Jamie Icke for doing that. Well done, pal. Good job, Jamie. And I want to say hi to Roger Cocker. Now, Roger's son, Harley, was working at Formby Beach yesterday, and I pulled up at Formby Beach with the future Mrs. Allen, and I was asking these two very nice guys about parking, and they came to charge me for parking, which is all right. You don't mind. You got to do it. And Harley said, you wouldn't be Richie Allen by any chance, would you? Would you even? And I said, I am. And he said, my dad listens. And his name is Roger Cocker, so give him a shout. So Roger, thanks for listening to the programme. Harley's a great lad too. Enjoyed meeting him yesterday at Formby, which is lovely. Lovely place. Live on Fab Radio 2, Tune In Radio. The Brexit Secretary, as you heard on the news, David Davis, was in Brussels again today to meet with his EU counterpart, Michel Barnier. And it's being described as round two of the negotiations to frame how the UK will leave the EU, what sort of terms we will leave on. Today's papers, well, again, you heard some of it in the news, full of Brexit and full of claims that there is blue murder in the Tory party, with Conservative MPs claiming that the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, is trying to frustrate Brexit. Now, he's been talking down Brexit as Hammond, warning of the dangers of a hard Brexit. He's been doing that a lot. He's positioning himself against Theresa May, in my opinion, and of course against David Davis, the Brexit Secretary, if there is a leadership contest soon. There probably will be, sooner rather than later. It's a mess. It's all a mess. And I suppose then again, this is why we got the dodgy manifesto, which destroyed Theresa May and the Tory majority, to destabilise this process of leaving the European Union. Now, Tony Blair has been all over the telly this weekend gone, speaking to everybody. Newsnight on Friday, Sky News on Saturday. Anybody who listened to Tony, he's happy to speak with them. He's thrilled with the way things are going, is Tony Blair, and says that Brexit probably won't happen. Probably won't happen, says Blair. Here he is.
I think it's possible now that Brexit doesn't happen. I think it's absolutely necessary that it doesn't happen, because I think every day is bringing us fresh evidence that it's doing us damage economically, certainly doing us damage politically. I think public opinion is moving on it. Look, this time last year we were the fastest growing economy in the G7, we're now the slowest. Our savings ratio is at the lowest for 50 years. The investment community internationally has now gone really negative on us.
Yeah, Blyer by nickname these days, Blyer, but liar by nature. Lies. Everything is on the up and up. What they're not telling you, and to be fair, neither are the so-called Brexiteers telling you, the people who are supposed to be in favour of leaving the European Union, is that countries in what we would call the lower socio-economic bracket around the world, third world countries, sub-Saharan countries, are queuing up to do deals with the UK. They are to buy our products, to sell theirs into our markets. It's absolutely true. But nobody will tell you. Sadly, Jeremy Corbyn, who I told you time and time again, is no champion of the downtrodden, of the poor, the working poor. He's no champion of democracy. He's anti-EU as Jeremy, but he wants to be the next Prime Minister, so he has to say he supports staying in the single market. And he has to say customs union. Tariff-free access, says Jeremy, which of course means free movement of people. Tell you more about free movement of people shortly. Given the chance to criticise what Tony Blair said, Jeremy Corbyn said this, and again, this is the Sky News.
Anyone's entitled to give their views, and I listen to all of them. The views we have are that we want to see tariff-free access to the European market, protection of European nationals, and protection of the labour rights and environmental conditions and consumer rights we achieved through European Union membership. And I hope Tony Blair and everybody else recognises that's what our position is, and that we do recognise the results of the referendum of a year ago.
Yeah, but of course Corbyn and Labour do not want to honour the results of the referendum. They want some sort of part membership of the EU, maybe the Norwegian scenario. The pretense of being out, but still having the European courts superseding UK law and staying in the so-called tariff-free single market. Jeremy Corbyn isn't what you think he is. Those of you who support him, he's not. You know, he's just another manifestation of the system. That's all he is. And Nigel Farage is none too impressed with any of this. Here's the former leader of UKIP again speaking with Sky News.
I think it's a pretty loathsome performance, frankly. I mean, he's showing people why he is now one of the most disliked living figures in British politics. He wants to reverse the result of a democratic referendum. He's making it clear that, you know, anything must be done to stop us leaving the EU. He suggests that public opinion has shifted. Well, actually, there are more people in favour of Brexit now than there were at the time of the referendum. But the real irony here is, of all the people to argue that we could get a reform deal with the European Union, Tony Blair is probably the worst placed person to do so, because he, as Prime Minister, was President of the EU for 6 months back in 2005. He promised reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. He got none, and yet gave away £7 billion of our rebate. So I don't think he's a trusted figure on this, or frankly, anything else.
Mm. Yes, of course, Farage doesn't go as far as Farage ought to go, in this presenter's opinion. Blair never sought to do any sort of deal which would have reformed the European Union back in the early to mid-2000s. Of course he didn't, in the early noughties. Blair has always been a paid-up member of the tyrannical, because that's what it is. Single European government, ultimately leading on to a one-world government. Now it gets worse. The media are outdoing themselves in their support of the EU. The BBC are world-class at this, as we know, but Sky were trying to outdo them today. They brought a guy on called Ryan Heath. Ryan Heath, I bet you've never heard of him. Well, Heath used to write speeches for José Manuel Barroso, who was the former president of the European Commission. Barroso is a big Goldman Sachs guy. Lovely, isn't it? Well, anyway, Heath used to write speeches for this guy. He's pro-European Union. Here is Ryan Heath, interviewed by Kay Burley on Sky News. You will hear Kay Burley first.
We heard from Vince Cable a couple of weeks ago now. He was speaking on one of our Sunday morning political programmes, and he was saying he would be surprised if Britain ever left the European Union. Is that sort of secretly what the rest of our European colleagues would like to see happen?
I think that is a bit of the open secret, the hope that people in here in Brussels have. They realise that there's not the appetite yet to actively call for some kind of second referendum, but they consider that it's possible you could move into some kind of transitional arrangement and then just keep extending that arrangement and never quite end up leaving the EU. Now, obviously, that's going to be red rag to the Tory Conservative bulls, so I'm not sure that that's ever going to get off the ground politically in the UK. The government is kind of cornered in having to push through for some kind of Brexit. But as we've all seen from 2016, a lot can change week to week in politics. So no one's completely willing to give up entirely on the UK as EU members. And that's why they keep pushing the UK to come forward and admit more of the reality of these negotiations. Because then it leaves that crack open in the door of people doubting should the Brexit actually happen.
Challenge from Kay Burley. Any challenge? Does Burley say, excuse me, the people voted to leave? The viewers of this programme might find your attitude extremely arrogant and certainly undemocratic, or at least the EU's attitude arrogant and undemocratic. No, of course not. Murdoch's pet girl, Kay Burley, chooses to mock Brexit Secretary David Davis. Her follow-up to what he just said is this.
One wonders what sort of options, as far as the Europeans are concerned, are still open in this second round for Britain. When David Davis leaves the United Kingdom and goes over the Channel, you know, he's full of bluff and bluster and confidence. What sort of reception does he receive when it comes to bargaining and negotiating?
Absolute garbage journalism there from Kay Burley. You won't be surprised. It's laughable. I won't play you the answer because the answer is irrelevant. Wonderfully biased and slanted reporting. Painting Davis as a bit of an idiot. Going over there with bluff and bluster to the A-team of negotiation, the world champions of negotiation, the European Union. You know, I said this when the UK chose to leave the EU last year, and I'll say it again. There is absolutely no need for 2 years of negotiation. There's no need for anything. This is a nonsense. What should have happened is, forget this Article 15, this triggering of 2 years. What the government could have done was said, we're out of your club. There's nothing to discuss, really. We're happy for those European citizens who have national insurance numbers and who are working and paying taxes here. We're happy for them to stay. Other than that, there's nothing to negotiate. Any deals we need doing, we'll do them individually with the finance ministers of the individual countries. Now, don't swear at me and throw tweets at me saying that's completely unrealistic. It isn't unrealistic. Listen, we're out of your grubby, undemocratic little club. From now on in, we're on our own. From now on in, we do whatever we fecking well want. No need for negotiations. We're gone. Everything is ripped up, gone, done. We don't owe any money. You don't owe us any money. Good luck to you. And you might want to negotiate as an entire block when it comes to trading, but we don't want to. We'll do individual discussions with individual companies. Excuse me, countries. Right? End of story. This negotiation is garbage. Oh, well, we negotiate as one unit. Well, we couldn't care less. What you want to do is one unit. We will meet the Germans, we'll meet the French, the Belgians, all the rest of them individually, and we'll say, we'll keep buying your goods, you keep buying our goods, everything will work out well in the end. Can't wait to hear from George Galloway in a minute. Do you want to know why it's vital that the UK even leaves now and with no deal with these tyrants? No deal. Leave with no deal tomorrow. Walk away from these clowns. Do you know why they should do that? Listen to this horrifying report from RT about the effects of migration in Italy on the Italian economy and on the Italian people. Listen to this.
Moving on now, a number of mayors in Italy are taking action over the latest influx of migrants, saying the country's being overwhelmed. Just last week, another 8,000 refugees arrived ashore. The mayor of a small town in Sicily launched his protest after receiving a call warning him that 50 migrants were to be accommodated in an old hotel nearby.
I'm upset because I'm the mayor of this town and the government literally went over our heads. I was alerted by the prefecture at around 10 o'clock in the evening when they told me some migrants were arriving. I told them, okay, I'm here, let me check. I arrived and the migrants were already here. The government had it all organized since the morning.
Well, after discovering the decision to accommodate the migrants was already made, he rallied locals on Facebook to blockade the hotel with their vehicles. They even managed to cut the power to the property, leaving the migrants in darkness. Speaking to reporters, the mayor directed his fury squarely at the government over its handling of Italy's latest migrant crisis.
We have been invaded, overrun, and overwhelmed by the migrant management system of these cooperatives, which know nothing about our communities.
Now, let me just say this, and I want this to be clear, because we have the identitarians listen to the programme, the socialists, who want to label me as some sort of UKIP supporter or some sort of right-wing, you know, anti-migration. Nothing could be further from the truth. Cutting the power to the house where those immigrants were staying was a despicable thing to do by the mayor of that town in Sicily. That was wrong. Taking your frustrations out on the poor, misfortunate creatures who are there for whatever reason, is the wrong way to go about it. Shouting at people, abusing people, and blaming the immigrants themselves is totally and utterly wrong. It's not Christian. It's not the Jewish thing to do. It's not the Muslim thing to do. It's wrong to do that. Never abuse people or make people feel worthless or unworthy. Don't do that. I was a bit disgusted. I can understand, you know, the economic pressure on towns that are being overwhelmed, as the mayor said, is devastating. But don't blame the poor feckers who are only doing what we would do if we were in third world countries or other countries looking for some sort of better economic future. Because I know it's not all Syrians and it's not all Libyans and it's not all Yemenis. I know that. There are economic migrants as well, which seems to piss people off more than anything. But don't take it out on them. It's not their fault. They're human beings. Treat them with humanity. Go after the bastards who are making it happen. So says Orazio Maria Gneri. Now, he's the president of the European Communitarianist Party. The European Communitarianist Party. He spells it out on RT.
What people should understand is not that they're not fight against the immigrants that are just a symptom of the problem. They have to fight against the European elite that is trying to destroy the European people. So it means taking action in the squares, in the streets, you know, with manifestations, rallies, and so on. Or, so much better, doing policies against the European Union on the political level.
Absolutely. If you feel you have to vote, and I don't recommend it, but vote for candidates who are committed to leaving the European Union, whether you're in Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, or the UK. Vote for candidates if you feel compelled to, and I certainly don't. Candidates who say out means out, no single market, none of that bollocks. We determine our future judicially, financially, and we decide when we need people to come in and work, and when we do, we get people to come in and work. Simple as that. Very quick break, back in a minute. 22 minutes past the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.
Great to have your company. This is Europe's most listened to independent radio show, the Richie Allen Show on DavidIke.com. George Galloway joins the program in a couple of minutes live. We'll be talking about the European Union, of course, after this from Madonna. Welcome back. music from Madonna on your Richie Allen Show. The time is 26 minutes past 7. Welcome back to the programme. Great to have your company as always this Monday. Thanks for choosing the programme. Massive interest in this on Twitter on the European Union's Philip Hammond, the Tories, Tony Blair and more. Besides, I did mention a little bit earlier on, there isn't very much that I can tell you about our first guest that you don't know already. He's a former MP, of course. He makes television and radio programmes these days with RT and Talk Radio. I'll tweet out links to those programmes. He made an excellent film last year. Came out this year, didn't it? Earlier this year, The Killings of Tony Blair. Terrific film. I can't recommend it highly enough. And he recently contested the by-election here in Manchester. And he done quite well too, despite it being a Labour stronghold for many, many, many years. Let's welcome back to the programme George Galloway. George, welcome back. Thanks for coming back.
No, thank you, Richie. Thanks for the opportunity.
Good to have you on, George. Is Brexit ever going to happen, or are we going to end up with some watered-down version of Brexit which won't be worth having in the first place? What do you think?
Well, I think that's an open question. There's no doubt there are very formidable forces now on the battlefield trying to kill it, led by the aforementioned Tony Blair and all his millions and his many millionaire friends. But not only them, of course, the big city interests, the bankers, the city slickers, the big captains of industry who never wanted Brexit in the first place, big business, and the civil service, the deep state, the BBC, most of the mainstream media are all against it. So it was a bit of a miracle that we won the Brexit referendum. But win it, we did. And then in the general election, 80% of the people voted either Conservative or Labour, both of whom were committed to Brexit. Only the Liberal Democrats and the nationalist parties, Scottish, Welsh and Irish, campaigned for another referendum and to stop the Brexit affair. So there are formidable forces on both sides, irresistible forces and immovable objects. So it's too early to say, I think, but the fighting inside the cabinet room that you alluded to there and which is all over the mainstream media today is a symptom of the struggle that's going on. And of course, the whole thing has been compounded by Theresa May going for an unnecessary general election, saying that she wanted to increase her majority, strengthen her hand, only to lose the hand that she had and lose the majority that she had. So Britain is going into this most complex and profound of processes effectively without a government, certainly without a government with any credibility in the nation as a whole. So too early to say, I would think, is the only proper answer to your question, Richie.
George, you were up here, of course, contesting the Gorton by-election, and you were busy enough with what you were doing yourself, but you must have been pretty surprised. You've been in politics, donkey's years. I mean, you've been around the block and you've seen everything. You must have been surprised at the tone of the Tory manifesto, you know, going after senior citizens, going after people who might need to use their savings to care for themselves later on. It seemed a bit suicidal, the manifesto, George. And you know, I'm a bit of a, you know, from our chats on Twitter and you coming on before, I'm a bit of a conspiracy theorist. I wonder about that manifesto. It was absolute lunacy, and it was only designed to do one thing, in my opinion, to weaken the majority that May had. Looking back at it, is there any cause for concern? Was there a fix in terms of that manifesto designed to make things, you know, difficult for May after the election? What do you think?
Well, I think that particular conspiracy theory falls because Theresa May herself wrote this manifesto. In fact, she excluded the Conservative Party very largely from her whole election campaign. She didn't even mention the word Conservative on the photo opportunities that they dressed up as rallies, which turned out to be, you know, a couple of dozen party functionaries in a warehouse somewhere, packed together and the shot taken in such a way as to imply that there was a big crowd there. It was Theresa May's team, you'll remember.
Yes.
And she personalized the entire election campaign. But you're right, you're onto something in that this was an election campaign like no other. I've been fighting general elections since 1964, when I was 10 years old and my house was transformed into a Labour committee rooms. Let's go with Labour was the slogan. Harold Wilson was the leader. And since 1964 until now, I have never seen an election campaign like it, punctuated as it was by grotesque acts of atrocities, terrorist atrocities, timeouts for mourning, Jeremy Corbyn being subjected to really quite hysterical personal abuse and allegations, and yet coming, as it were, from nowhere and getting almost 13 million votes, more than Harold Wilson ever got, and the biggest increase in the Labour vote since Clement Attlee in 1945.
That's right.
The Tories starting out their campaign predicting a majority of 150 and ending up the campaign with absolutely no majority in the House of Commons at all. So something very badly wrong happened from the point of view of the Conservative Party. And it's easy to infer, therefore, that somebody fixed it in reverse. But I don't think so myself.
Yeah.
You see, I often ask this question, Richie, and it's where I sometimes differ from you. Are we led by James Bonds or Austin Powers? And some people think it's James Bond, but I think it's Austin Powers. We're led by incompetent fools rather than knaves, although they're oftentimes knaves as well.
It's an interesting one, George. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was... I'm glad you brought up the team, the dodgy team that have since left Theresa May's side, and I'd love to know just how influential they were in terms of coming up with those policies, which were, you know, a dagger to the heart of the Conservative Party base. But I take your point, George. I don't have all the answers. I just have questions. On Jeremy Corbyn, whom I, you know, really want to like, because my opinions on a lot of things would be aligned with his and with yours. But I know that Jeremy is as anti-European Union in terms of the, you know, what the European Union is, as you are, and yet he persists with this, we want access, we want tariff-free access to the single market and the customs union, and he knows that that's going to obviously be offset by the European Union saying, well, you can have it, but you must also have freedom of movement. And like you, I'm no racist or xenophobe, but I'm aware that, you know, unfettered immigration has had a big effect on public services, as you are. Jeremy is not really in a comfortable position. I don't see him anyway. He's saying things that I don't think he really means. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying you want access to the single market. Obviously, one wants access to any markets that are going and with as few tariffs and barriers as possible. But access to the single market is a totally different thing from membership of the single market. And there are many people in the Labour Party, in Parliament, who are in favour of membership of the single market. And as you rightly said in the beginning of that question, being a member of the single market is actually worse than being a member of the European Union, because you're subject to all the bad things about the European Union. You'd be transferring them money every year, every week, millions. You'd be transferring them hundreds of millions of pounds every year. You'd be subject to the jurisdiction of the European courts, and you'd have to accept the capitalists' wet dream, which is what the free movement of cheap labour into the British labour market actually is. It is astonishing that people who consider themselves, or at least tell us, that they're on the left in politics who want to continue with a policy which was designed for corporations, by corporations, to facilitate the mass movement, 3.2 million now EU citizens living in Britain, of workers from countries where the minimum wage is in some cases 10 times less than ours. In Bulgaria, for example, the average hourly wage is £1 per hour. And so if you were a Bulgarian, you'd have to be mad not to come here if you could. I'd blame no Bulgarian, of course. My own grandparents came in their bare feet from Ireland for precisely the same reasons. But as someone in the British labour movement with a duty to defend wages and conditions, I have to say no to that. And the argument that comes back from the left is, well, it's not the fault of the millions of immigrants that the public services are in such a state. It's the Tories and Tory ideas and ideology, neoliberal economics, and all that. And of course, that's true. But if my auntie had a beard, she'd be my uncle. And she doesn't have a beard, and that's why she's my auntie. And you can't wish away the fact that our public services have been ravaged by austerity for decades. And therefore, in those circumstances, an influx of cheap labor can only, simple economics, can only drive down wages and conditions, put pressure on rents, and further pressure on already devastated public services. As anyone looking for a house or a doctor's appointment or a place for their child in the school or any of the other public services that have been ravaged already knows. And, you know, I'm speaking to you now from central London. The picture looks different from here. Here you get cheap European labor serving you your espresso macchiato impeccably and cheaply, and very nice people they all are too. You can get an au pair, you can get a babysitter, you can get a nanny, you can get somebody to repair your window, do your joinery work, and so on. But in industrial Britain, post-industrial Britain, in the wasteland, or what the Americans call the Rust Belt, the whole picture looks different. And that's why we won the Brexit referendum, even though every expert, every pundit, every part of the commentariat, and every political leader from the political class said that there was no chance that we would vote for Brexit. But we did.
When George Galloway is on the line, by the way. We've got George for about another 10 minutes or thereabouts. Good to have him back on the programme. At George Galloway on Twitter. Follow George if you haven't followed him already on Twitter. George, of course, this year released The Killings of Tony Blair. It's a terrific film. I recommend you watch it. It's on Netflix if you have Netflix, if you subscribe to it. But if not, it's certainly worth a couple of bobs. So go and rent it from one of these online movie renting sites. George, we saw what happened when the Irish rejected Lisbon. They came back a year later. I was working for WLRFM in Waterford City at the time. It's where I started. And I've always been anti, you know, these political unions like the European Union, which like you, I've always said, were ultimately designed by capitalists to power grab and money grab, to grab everything. I've always been against them. They came back and said to the Irish, we didn't like your answer, we'd like another one, please. They did it in Denmark. We have people like Vince Cable and Tony Blair. I'm bringing this around to Tony Blair now. Arrogantly, despicably going on national news programmes, completely ignoring the fact that 52% of the populace said last year they had enough of the status quo, they wanted a change. And these guys are saying, A, Brexit might not even happen, and B, well, we could have a referendum again, you know, sometime in the near future. You campaigned diligently to bring about a leave vote. What do you think when you see Tony Blair on television saying, we'll come out, don't worry about it, it's not over yet, we'll come out. Or excuse me, we won't come out, we're not going to leave. What do you think, George?
Well, I wrote about this at the weekend and I recalled The Second Coming, the great epic poem by W.B. Yeats, when he talked about the best of them lacking conviction and the worst of them filled with passionate intensity. And as I watched Blair in This Second Coming, I could see etched on his face all the terrifying intensity with which he led us into the war in Iraq, which is still, of course, blazing everywhere around the world, from Mindanao to Manchester. And it made me, frankly, a little bit afraid, because this man, when gripped with such passionate intensity, is a clear and present danger to the country. And he's effectively working for the foreign powers involved in the negotiations with the British government over Britain's withdrawal. He's seeking to encourage the European Union negotiators to drive the hardest possible bargain to make the whole thing as ugly a breakfast as possible, so that the demand for an Irish-type rerun, hopefully from their point of view, becomes irresistible. And that's a fifth column, actually. That is a betrayal of the national interest, and it wouldn't be the first time that Tony Blair has been guilty of that. So it frightened me to some extent, but there's another way of looking at it. So discredited is Tony Blair, so deeply unpopular, even hated amongst large sections of the population, that the Ramoners must be in pretty bad shape if they are forced to turn to the worst of them because of their passionate intensity. It must mean that they realize that Vince Cable et al., it just won't cut it. And something, some kind of last throw is therefore involved. And we'll have to see how that works out. One thing's for sure, the big money is now about to come onto the field. Blair has set up this institute. He's put, he said, you've always got to be careful when it comes to him,
yeah,
£10 million of his own money. I'd like to see the receipt, actually. But he's also fundraising amongst the oligarchy, amongst the ruling elite in Britain. And I believe that it's not impossible that they'll put maybe £100 million into this campaign. And that buys a lot of bucks. And so we'll have to, that's why I'm not able to answer your very first question definitively at this point.
Yeah,
will Brexit ultimately happen? I'm not so sure. But I'm going to fight for it with every breath I have.
And that's why I worry, you know, that's why I mentioned the Irish situation, because you mentioned a few minutes ago the media overwhelmingly supports the UK staying in the European Union. Now, not your programmes and the programmes of your colleagues, but the global media supports the UK staying in. I mean, we had a horrendous situation today when Sky News interviewed a guy called Ryan Heath, who used to write George speeches for José Manuel Barroso. And staggeringly, the Sky News presenter, a woman called Kay Burley, who's interviewed you, I'm sure, many times, was actually openly mocking David Davis in the way that Davis, you know, moves his operation to Brussels to negotiate with Michel Barnier. And there's this constant thing of knocking it, bringing people on programmes completely unbalanced, George, saying that it's a disaster, we're all screwed, we're all doomed. And then you have the presenter saying it as well. And my worry is they just beat people down. Eventually there's a second referendum. And you've been around, George. You said you were 10 in the 60s at home watching politics. You know that what happens in a second referendum is a lot of people passionately committed to leaving the European Union who went out to vote the first time around, they don't go out the second time around, George, and staying in the European Union wins the day. I'm really pessimistic about it, to be honest. I've seen it before, and I think I'm seeing it again.
Well, you may be right. I think you're definitely right up to a point. What the final point, what the final outcome will be, I think is still in play. There's a YouGov poll today which showed that the great majority of people now in Britain, far bigger majority than we got in the Brexit referendum, just want to make the best of this now, want to get the best out of the negotiations and get on with it. That can change, of course, and you're right to talk about the job that's being done. David Davis is actually the only Tory minister in the cabinet who could be depended on to actually bring Brexit about. And so there's a big job being done to portray him as a kind of dullard and to split his base. They've even, believe it or not, created a carnival of publicity around Jacob Rees-Mogg, everything from his offspring to his nanny to his ancestral home and his 1936 Bentley and his children who look like they walked out of the 50s, the 1950s, I mean, not the 1850s. This is to further divide the Tory Brexit camp. And, of course, Theresa May never wanted Brexit in the first place. I agree with you. It's something I wanted to say earlier, if I may. Jeremy Corbyn should have done what Harold Wilson did in the referendum in 1975. He should have declared it a free vote and said that all Labour members were free to campaign according to their own conscience on this subject. And if he had done that and campaigned as he genuinely believes, or at least believed until less than 2 years ago, that Britain should leave the EU, then the whole case would have been stronger now, and he would have been stronger for it too.
Final listeners are asking me to ask you, what do you think of the DUP and what happened in, you know, in that negotiation and promises being made to send money to Northern Ireland that, you know, people who need it here on the mainland are saying, well, you know, there was no money. There was no blank checks until the DUP were prepared to prop up the government. You might answer that in a second. But before that, do you think Jeremy's gotten a whiff of power, George? You know, he's gotten a whiff of the possibility he might be in Downing Street, and he has tempered his positions accordingly. What do you think?
Well, no, I think it's more than a whiff. I think he fully expects that this government will not last, and he might be right about that. Although, having paved the streets of East Belfast in gold, the Conservatives have purchased a lot of leverage over the 10 MPs of the DUP. And there's also, you would never not accuse the Liberal Democrats of promiscuity. The Liberal Democrats are also in discussion with government business managers. Not quite the full coalition, not quite a ministerial Montegos, but some kind of deal with the Liberal Democrats. So the Parliament could last the distance, though I doubt if the Prime Minister will last the distance. Now, I think Corbyn has fought a pretty magnificent campaign against odds that looked insurmountable, and he's now in a very strong position, certainly. Even Tony Blair had to acknowledge that in his interviews over the weekend. So the DUP could have thunk it.
Yeah.
She went into the election looking for a big majority, and she's ended up hanging on to power from the tassels of an orange sash.
End of story, basically. That's it. Yeah, it's a disaster, isn't it? Finally on that, what are the implications for the peace process in Northern Ireland, do you think, of that? Or are we far enough down the road now that, you know, the parties, the Republican parties and the Loyalist parties in the North will just carry on? What do you think, George, finally?
Well, I think it's a pretty grave situation. It's arguably unlawful because the Anglo-Irish Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, requires neutrality on the part of the British government, as between the nationalist and loyalist communities. And that's impossible to maintain when you're actually in a formally agreed coalition with the loyalist MPs at Westminster. And of course, the executive has collapsed and shows no sign of being resurrected. So direct rule from Westminster is now effectively in place, even though the government that's exercising that direct rule is in bed with one part of the community. And it's therefore very, very dangerous. And all the ugliness that we saw again during this marching season focused a lot of British people's attention. This is maybe a subject for another debate, but focused a lot of people's attention on just exactly why is six counties in the northeast of Ireland in the British state in the first place. Certainly, I don't want them in the British state. They don't have anything to do with me. And as I look at them hanging effigies, racist banners, effigies of the Pope and all the rest of it, it's hard to believe that these people live in the same state as us. Not only that, we're giving them billions of pounds that could otherwise have been spent in Greater Manchester, for example, and many other parts of the country, where public expenditure is desperately needed. And the money tree that they said never existed turns out to be alive and fructifying all along.
George, it was great catching up with you again. Folks, you can catch George on Sputnik on RT. Check out his talk radio show as well on Talk Radio. Follow him on Twitter. It's at George Galloway. And The Killings of Tony Blair is a terrific film. I do mean that. My word is gold. It's a really good film. You can rent that from a number of online retailers, or you can check it out on Netflix if you're a subscriber. Thanks for the time today, George. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
Look after yourself.
Thanks, Richie.
Cheers, mate. Bye for now. That was George Galloway on the line there, as he said, from London, talking about the intervention of Tony Blair and others in the UK negotiation with the European Union. 7 minutes to the top of the hour. Thanks for the tweets on that. I'll get to them in a couple of minutes' time. Before we do that, though, let's have a quick break.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Welcome back, Yvonne, my Irish friend in Austria. How you doing, Yvonne? Wasn't that done purposefully to bring back the troubles in Northern Ireland, says Yvonne, referring to the DUP deal with the Tories. I don't know, Yvonne. I don't know. But it's a point worth making even. Garrett Donnelly, how you doing, Garrett? The last people who told us what to do were kindly asked to desist and then asked to move along. Marks, oh, there's a conversation going on there. This is the thing about Twitter. I end up getting caught in the middle of conversations. Hi to Paul Jackson. Out or in? We all have to go to work, pay taxes. It makes no difference. The whole Brexit is a sham, says Paul Jackson. Thanks for the comment, Paul. Mark Morrison says, I wonder what Keith Vaz has to say after his Brexit Holocaust speech in the early hours after the result. I'm not going to read the next bit, Mark, because that would be libelous. And I would get into trouble. Hi to Angela, who is Italian, who says the only place Blair should be allowed to speak is at the International Criminal Court at The Hague, says Angela. Angela, you know, I lie awake at night, and I'm not saying this for a laugh or for effect. I do lie awake at times dreaming of Tony Blair in the dock at The Hague answering for the millions of people he's killed. But The Hague and the ICC is only for black tin pot Central African dictators. The ICC is a sham as well. It's a sham. People always say, oh, Bush in The Hague. The United States are not signed up to the ICC, so Bush would never be taken to The Hague. Yeah, what is it? Three minutes to the top of the hour. Don't forget, Peter Robbins joins the programme for the first time. I know many of you, including our Simon at Richie Allen Show Towers, if such a thing existed, and it doesn't. Simon really excited about that. Anybody into ufology, the study of extraterrestrial life, the nature of reality, the study of human origin, you don't want to miss Peter Robbins, who joins this programme in a couple of minutes' time. Just a couple of quick comments about last week. I did put a very tongue-in-cheek rant, and it was totally tongue-in-cheek, by the way. You know, I've got a weird sense of humour. And it was about one or two people complaining about the programme going off air on Wednesday because the tinternet went down. Apparently I was halfway through a sentence. I kept talking for about 4 minutes until somebody rang me. And the mobile, of course, is on silent all the time. But I could hear the vibration. I thought, what's going on? And it was somebody telling me, you're not on. And then, of course, we didn't do Thursday or Sunday. So we've only missed 2 days. But I just want to reiterate, and this is in no way to virtue signal. It isn't at all. And it's in no way to gain your admiration. But as well as we do in terms of our output, our sound, our professionalism, it is still ultimately, in terms of the live show, a one-man operation out of a self-contained independent studio in South Manchester with no engineer, no producers. It's just us. It's just me, basically, doing everything. So on the odd occasion when something goes wrong, you just have to put up with it. There's nothing you can do. You know, at TPV in London, there were a team of studio engineers and people doing stuff. I have Aaron and Simon who do great and important jobs, but post-production jobs. Post-production. Pre-production and live, it's me on my own. Sans help, sans cordia. Cordia means friends, by the way, in Irish. Just me. So every now and then something will go wrong. We have to put up with it. That's all I'm saying. You know, I've never been one to throw my ties out of the pram when things go, you know, belly up. Just get on with it. And we'll do a show the following day and the following day and the following day. It's a wonderful operation here. But it is just me. Keep that in mind, right? And I say that because I do get emails from people who say, it's a wonderful production. It sounds great. It's great. It sounds marvellous. Marvellous production. You talk a lot of bollocks, Richie, but it sounds great. You know, you've got a lot of good people working with you. No, I don't. Just me. It's just me. Do you want to have some music? Let's have some music. Keep the tweets coming in. At Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Richie at richieallen.co.uk is the email address. Here's a bit of Joan Jett. On your Richie Allen Show, the top of the hour on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, and TuneIn Radio. I love rock and roll. Back in a minute with Peter Robbins.
By the record machine, I knew he must have been about 17. He was so strong, playing my favorite song, and I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me, yeah, me. And I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me. Ah!
Jett, I love rock and roll on the Richie Allen Show. The time is exactly 3 minutes past the hour. Our next guest is a special man, and I've been looking forward to speaking with him on the programme for a long time. He is an author, an investigative reporter, a journalist who has spent 3.5 decades investigating ufologies. He's travelled the world giving lectures, appearing on every television show you can think of. He's contributed to many, many documentaries. I will be putting links to his website on Twitter and on Facebook for those of you who are new to his work. And I will also link to you to his books as well. He was recently in Mexico. I'm fascinated by pretty much everything he does. And we're going to have a kind of a general conversation with him about his life, how he got into writing about extraterrestrials, UFOs, contact, the politics around that today in 2017 in terms of governments. But also he specialises in things like the career of luminaries like Wilhelm Reich, and I'm fascinated by Reich. I used to know Peter Ind, the jazz bassist, very, very well, who is a big fan and a follower of the work of Reich. Without any further ado, let's welcome to the programme, live from New York City, Mr. Peter Robbins. Peter, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Rich. I'm fine. And actually, you've got me in the center of New York State right now, just outside of Ithaca, New York. That's known for being the location of Cornell University.
Fantastic, Peter. Listen, first of all, thanks for coming on and doing this. I've been after you for a while. A lot of our listeners are very familiar with your work and your books. It's great to have you on the program. It really is. For those of our listeners who are new to you, Peter, how did you get into this? I mean, I know, you know, you've degrees in film history and painting, visual arts. How did you get into this fascinating and very important subject?
Good question. It certainly didn't have to do with my career choice. At the time that I became involved in 40 years ago, I was pursuing my career as a young painter in New York City, living, eating, and breathing the New York City art world with no intention of having anything get in my way of having this fascinating life that I had to a degree really dreamt about having since I was a kid. I was very lucky to be taken to all of the New York museums from before I can remember by my wonderful grandparents, my great aunt, my folks, and still love museums of any kind. And one afternoon, I was taking a break in my loft in the eastern part of New York City's Chinatown, where I lived and worked at the time. And I was going through some childhood drawings that I had done from about the age of 6 through about the age of 14 or something. And I know that that was one of the triggers. There were several other reasons. I think what happened happened, most important of which was that I was really able to begin to deal with what I'm about to tell you at that time. But a childhood memory that I had completely clamped down on and made myself forget from more than 14 years before this came roaring back like a freight train in my head and began to literally replay like a film loop. I was overwhelmed. It was a memory that went back to the early 1960s when I was a kid growing up on Long Island in a little village about 30 miles east of Manhattan on a beautifully clear late spring or early summer, late morning. It happened with my sister Helen, and we were playing as kids do, just goofing around on the front lawn. Not a cloud in the sky, I should say, and no one else around. And I caught out of my right peripheral vision something move in the sky and had enough time to either say, look, or Helen. I say that with the understanding that sometime after this memory returned, wanting to know if there were more details to it or to validate it, I underwent hypnotic regression on three occasions with three different hypnotists, two of them who were two of my mentors in my early work in ufology, one being the painter Bud Hopkins, who went on to become the best known and most respected person in the field of the scientific study of UFO abduction, and the other a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who was also a crack UFO investigator and who taught me to investigate the phenomena in a very pragmatic, real-world way. And there, above us, were five silvery white, disc-shaped objects that were metallic, not shiny like stainless steel, you know, more subdued like, say, brushed aluminum. And they were in a precise military kind of V, as in Victor, formation. They were also close enough, I should say, that both Helen and I could make out regular detailing around the edge of each, which after the fact, when we finally talked about this more than 14 years after the fact, we both agreed only read like windows would on a commercial airliner at an appreciable distance. I was overwhelmed. I thought I might be going a little crazy.
Yeah.
I'm sure in the world of psychology, the phrase repressed memory syndrome had not yet come into play. And in the mid-70s, there was bloody little out there having to do with the abduction phenomena or, well, there was plenty on UFO sightings, but nothing that ever interested me. I had other interests as a kid. And I really didn't know what to do or say for a while. I was in shock, really. How could anybody forget something like this? Except that we know countless people who have undergone more conventional and worse traumas than I certainly did have done just that, to keep themselves separate from it until and unless they could deal with it. And after a while, I calmed down and realized there was only one thing that I could do, which was call my sister. And find out if she shared that memory. And I did have the foresight before doing so to think it through and to realize if I just blurted it all out, she'd say yes or no. But in my heart and mind, I might never know for sure if that's what she remembered, if I fed her all the information. So I called her, asked her if it was a good time to talk. At that time, my sister lived a mile or so north of me in the East Village. She was a poet, making her living in part as a brilliant seamstress, making one-of-a-kind leather outfits for rock and rollers, and really on the verge of breaking through into being a very successful singer, songwriter, and performer herself, but that was yet to come. And I set the scene. I basically told her I had had a memory return and told her about when it was during the year, what the weather was like, where we were standing, And Richie, she cut me off mid-sentence and just laughed and said, stop, I know what you're talking about.
Wow, Peter. Marvelous.
And then confirmed the memory and added a great deal more, which dovetailed into her memories of what we would now call an archetypical UFO abduction, which absolutely shattered the foundations of my life. My career as a painter derailed, and over the next weeks, months, and years, my obsession with this subject and what had happened to my sister ultimately manifested as what I'll laughingly call my career in ufology.
It's an amazing story, that, Peter. It's an incredible story. And, you know, you talk about repressed memories. You wonder about why you didn't remember that, whether it was something, whether it was the visitors themselves, or whether there was some human element who were aware of this and who didn't want you to remember. You know, it opens up all sorts of questions, doesn't it?
Well, it does, except that I'm as sure as I can be of why that happened. And it doesn't have a very exotic explanation. I was a straight as an arrow little kid at 13, 14 years old. I was still a Boy Scout, very unsophisticated. It was a good time to come of age as a kid in America in many respects, especially for a lucky white middle-class kid like me, living in a very pretty little village with great parents and great sisters, and not, you know, I'm quite a happy childhood. For me, my passions at the time were things like collecting rocks and stamps and bugs and coins. Flying saucers were real to me. On the Saturday afternoons, I'd go with my little buddies to the local movie theater, and we'd watch a fun black and white movie. But I think I intuited the adult message that this wasn't real. And that is how I looked at them. And it shattered everything I thought I knew about life as I stood there and we looked at them. And it lasted for a long time, certainly minutes, and that's forever in a situation like that. I also was at that age being run by my hormones, and I will half joke with you and say that at that age, the main preoccupation in my life was girls and somehow, some way connecting with one. And I thought, well, you know, there's a law of physics that if you tell a girl something, every girl in the world will know. And if I were ever to share this with a girl, I would be a laughing stock. And this thing called sex that I'm very interested in might never happen to me. And again, I'm only half kidding. These were the things that were running my life.
Of course, you're a red-blooded young man. Yeah.
I clamped down on it, and successfully, obviously. My life went on. Nothing rattled it loose. And 14 and a half years later, it rattled loose.
It rattled loose. So when you've had this conversation with your sister, it's an incredible revelation, and you're coming to terms with that and the implications of it. Where do you go from there, Peter? Because you did mention, you know, the 1970s, it's not like it is now when our listeners are listening to Peter Robbins, some of them for the first time. They've got wonderful resources. You know, they've just got their laptop or their tablet and they can go and find stuff out. You didn't have any of that access back then. So how did you begin to even start looking into the subject? How did you do it, Peter? Where did you go from there?
Well, I was very fortunate in many respects. One of them was I grew up in a house of readers. My folks both read a lot. There were books around the house. When we moved from New York City out to this little village when I was 7 years old, one of the first things I did with my mom, and it was a great point of pride with me, was she took me to the local library, which had a large children's department. And at 7 years old, I had my first library card, and I started taking out books. But more, I not only became an avid reader, which I still am, I became a book lover and a bibliophile. And next to the art that I've been lucky enough to put together and have in my house, my library is, I guess, my most valuable asset. And I began to build that part of my library. And despite you know, so much that is available, an overwhelming amount of information that's available to us online, I would always recommend to people who are interested or developing a serious interest in this subject that they get out there and begin to build their actual libraries. There is so much specious nonsense that is unconfirmable and absolutely off the charts online. Normally, I mean, anyway, you have to be very discerning and critical and skeptical as you build your database, but even more so with all of these internet sources. So I began to put together books. I started, you know, going to bookstores, lots of them in New York City, and buying books and reading them. I realized fairly early on there was a whole subculture of books, contact ebooks, Welcome the Space Brothers, things I thought were really outrageous that I thought it was important for me to know about if I was developing a serious interest in the subject.
I was
looking for more pragmatic sources, and books by the American writers Donald Kehoe, one of the first of the truly scientific UFO writers starting back in the 50s, Edward Ruppelt, a former head of Project Blue Book. These were books I paid more attention to. At the same time, for almost a year, although Helen and I now had an open line on this and we're talking about it regularly, and she was very public about her experiences. She didn't give a damn what people thought. She never backed down from her accounts. But I was not really interested in meeting other people who alleged that, you know, they were serious researchers or whatever. I thought they had to be crazy. I knew I wasn't. But if you're an adult involved in the work, part of my conditioning, one of the reasons I've spent so much time researching what I call the origins of the ridicule factor about UFOs, is just that. But after about a year, I did connect with several knowledgeable, grounded, terrific people who really helped me into the work. And by the mid, later 70s, I gave my first talk on the subject, and by the early 80s, had lectured at my first conference, and I was off and running.
You're off and running. Now, what's really fascinating is hearing you talking about building your library and ultimately meeting people. How did you learn to differentiate between the people that had, in your opinion, genuinely had an abduction experience, or they might have been genuine in terms of their belief, but they might have had, you know, they might have had difficulties, they might have had problems, and then and then the whole, because I always believe, Peter, there are three categories. There are people who were definitely abducted and who had an experience. There are people who feel something happened to them, but it's part of maybe some illness maybe that they have. And thirdly, there's the out-and-out hoaxers. What characteristics did the honest people, did the real, you know, abductees, what characteristics did they share, you know, that led you to understanding that these people are the real deal, they've really had the experience?
Yeah, well, that's another wonderful question, Richie. First, my sister Helen and I were particularly close as a brother and sister. We shared a lot of the same friends, similar career paths, same senses of humor. Once we became writers, we often acted as each other's editors. We dated each other's friends. She was one of the best friends I had ever had, and losing her in 2000 was the worst thing that ever happened to me. But I took her seriously. And that was terribly important. In other words, I had an anchor in the real world. There was no reason for her to invent something like this.
No.
I didn't believe it then. I'll never believe it now. And I learned a little about Betty and Barney Hill. They were the best known and best documented abductees, as we call them, that there was some knowledge of at that time. Their case still stands absolutely unassailable in so many respects. But I didn't focus my attention on the abduction phenomena for some years. However, about a year or so after this memory came back and I was involved in this obsession, there's nothing else to call it, I read an article by a new UFO researcher that was published in a New York City Weekly magazine newspaper called The Village Voice. And it was the best written news article I had read thus far. Most of what I had read before that, other than books, were clippings, often from tabloids, that were sensational and rather superficial and ungrounded, or, you know, not backed up by anything evidentiary. And I thought, I have to meet this guy. Also, the fact that the New York art world is a very small place if you're deeply involved in it. And I thought, it's interesting that this person has the same name as a late period abstract expressionist painter whose work I've seen, named Bud Hopkins. And I went to the New York City phone book. I cold called this guy, who invited me over a few days later, and we chatted. And Bud Hopkins went on to become one of my dearest friends, closest confidants, greatest teachers, and on and off for probably close to half of our 35-year friendship, my employer, although that employment consisted of working as a volunteer.
Right.
as he established himself and emerged as the leading researcher in the field of abduction. What that did for me, Richie, was put me in a position, starting after that part of his career kicked in, his first book being published in 1981, Missing Time, a seminal book that I can't recommend too highly for anyone interested in a rational introduction to an unbelievable topic. And then in 87, when his second book, Intruders, became an international bestseller, I began to work with him in earnest on a very regular basis, and had the privilege of kind of being the fly on the wall as he investigated hundreds of claims of abduction. Now, for folks who are new to this subject, it just sounds so fabulously impossible that, you know, it's got to be a dysfunction. My favorite mantra about it is, it can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else.
Yeah.
And official science and naysayers and debunkers have been trying to explain it away for decades, unsuccessfully, especially for the people that have these experiences. One thing that was a thread that ran through, I would say, every authentic account, and I met these people, I spent time with them, sometimes their families, I was privy to medical records that showed extraordinarily anomalous aspects of their life, their physiology, implants, missing pregnancies, generational stories backed up by parents and grandparents, or children. And none of these people wanted any money. Very few of them were glad that it had happened to them. I salute those who come through these things without significant trauma, or being able to accept it. That's pretty special in this culture, where very little in our Judeo-Christian heritage or our, you know, book educations has prepared us for anything like this. Their sincerity, the emotions that came through, sometimes reliving what were the most frightening or shocking moments of their life in deep regressive hypnosis with Bud, who was a master practitioner and had not just trained to do that work, but for the first 7 years that he did, unlike just about anybody else I know in that field, worked directly under the supervision of a marvelous psychotherapist named Aphrodite Clamart, who was a very respected hypnotherapist back in the day. They rang true. And there were aspects of accounts that were backed up by evidence you could bring into a court of law. Physiological changes to material involved where it happened, neighbors, other witnesses seeing, you know, craft coming and going. In one of the most famous, the so-called Brooklyn Bridge UFO abduction case, published as a book called Witnessed, certainly the most challenging and extraordinary and best documented abduction case I've ever worked in. a woman was abducted through her plate glass window in a New York high-rise, not a monster building, but a 10th or 12th floor, and observed floating out that window into a fully lit up craft at 2 or so in the morning with a number of beings. It's New York City, people are awake. And who knows how many people saw it, but dozens of them reported what they saw to Bud. And as a pair of trained artists, I know one of the most dramatic aspects were people sent us drawings of what they had seen. And I should stress here that those drawings came in envelopes with different postmarks, with different handwritings from different parts of greater New York. Many by people who Bud was able to sit down and meet with, many of whom gave their permission to include those drawings. And if it was just, there it was, you know, from 360 degrees, the same color, the same shape, the same descriptions. And I thought I saw, it was a movie being made, that kind of thing.
Well, Peter, but, do you know what? This of course, destroys the debunkers, because the debunkers like to talk about, you know, hysteria, and they like to talk about mental illness. But this was a time before email, before Facebook, before social media. And people all over the world were describing experiences that were similar right down to a T. And this is where I became fascinated in it. And I, many years ago, was lucky enough to interview Whitley Strieber. I think I should say Strieber, not Strieber. Because I read Communion as a young boy. And yes. Never thought for a minute I would ever do a program like this. And back in 2009, I managed to get Whitley on the line and spend a half an hour talking to him. And I absolutely believe him, because like you, I've not seen what you've seen. But through your eyes, your work, I've seen all of these people with all of these absolutely similar experiences that could not be collusion. And then the implants, Peter. I mean, holy Jesus, this is serious stuff. We're talking about people that have things inside their body. And in some cases, there's no external evidence of the insertion, which is extraordinary stuff when you think about it.
Yes, you know, literally. There's no sign of, a surgical placement. And I know Whitley. In fact, I had the privilege of proofreading the manuscript for Intruders as Bud's assistant with Whitley's encouragement. And if you take out your copy, you will note in the dedication or in the foreword that it is dedicated to Bud Hopkins, who saved my life or helped save my life. I'm not speaking out of school here to say that Whitley was suicidal in terms of his upset with what was happening with him and his family and certain friends that were visiting them at their place in upstate New York. That book was terribly important in that iconic cover caught the attention of so many people, not just in the US and the UK, but around the world. I think it must have gone into at least 20 translations. And interestingly, as a follow-up, and Whitley could certainly confirm this. We unfortunately lost Bud in 2011 to cancer. But the hundreds of people that wrote Bud about it, and I expect the thousands and possibly thousands of people that wrote Whitley about it, literally all at one point or another said, you know, I saw your book, I picked it up. And if they had the experience, in literally every case, they said, but the being I saw did not look like that. It looked like such and such. That cover was the invention of a cover artist, an illustrator who Bud linked Whitley up with it. And in the most surprising way, it was an extraordinary confirmation of people saying, I didn't see this, I saw that, of describing the archetypical gray type being ubiquitously associated with this kind of experience.
Peter, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a very, very quick break. It's only 60 seconds. We've got Peter Robbins on the line, folks. Go to peterrobbinsny.com, peterrobbinsny.com. I've already tweeted that link out there. Peter is a world-renowned writer, investigative writer, journalist, reporter in the field of ufology, much more besides as well, spoken all over the world, appeared on dozens and dozens of very, very good radio and television programs and documentaries. I just realised, Peter, it was an absolute folly to book you for an hour. We should have done the full program. And I will, with your permission, of course, get you back on real soon. We'll do a full show because there's so many other areas of your work. I really wanted to talk about Reich, but we're on this. Twitter is absolutely alive. And my Twitter account with people asking questions. There's some really, really interesting questions on there. We will get through one or two of them. But when we come back from the break, let's spend a bit of time talking about whether these are interdimensional or extraterrestrial. And in your four decades of experience, where you are today in terms of where why this is happening. This is fascinating stuff. Peter Robbins is going to stay with us till the top of the hour, till the end of the programme. Very quick break. Loads of tweets on this. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Richie at richieallen.co.uk. Don't go anywhere. Only a 60-second break. The great Peter Robbins back with me after these.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.
And I'm really delighted that Peter Robbins, the investigative writer, the reporter, the great journalist, given his life over to investigating extraterrestrial phenomena, abductions, and much more besides. Like I said, Reich, and there's so much that Peter has gotten into over the decades. Great he's on. PeterRobbinsNY.com. Big shout out to Nigel Code, who's a great friend of mine in Waterford City in the Republic of Ireland. Nigel is hugely interested in this subject, and he'll be listening to this avidly. Peter, thanks so much for staying with me. Great to have you on the programme. Just before we talk about what it is that's going on, and I know there's no short answer to that, and I'm not going to try and rush you on it. Anne Selly, who's in Cheltenham, asks, what does Peter think of the Nazca mummies, and what effect will that have on disclosure? Interesting question from Anne. If you want to take that one before we talk about the abductions again and what's really going on. The Nazca mummies, Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And great question, Anne, and best to you in Cheltenham, home of a gorgeous cathedral. I know the city a little bit. I have, like most of us, been following this story. My critical facilities kicked in almost immediately, and for me, if something looks too good to be true, it often is not true. It would be wonderful if this artifact, these three artifacts, as I understand it, pan out to be truly authentic. That would be a paradigm shifter. I am going to continue to follow the official investigation, also the investigation being led by my dear friend and colleague from Manchester, Steve Mira, publisher of the terrific monthly Phenomena magazine, as well as other independent critiques and studies of what's going on. In such situations, whether you have $1 million in a laboratory with every piece of equipment imaginable and a team of assistants, your best investigative tools are and will always be your critical thinking, good deductive reasoning, and common sense. There are some smoke signals here for me that suggest that this might not be what it appears to be. At the same time, for so many people, the mantra, the very carefully selected words that we were all introduced to in the pilot episode of the always memorable show, The X-Files, was not selected randomly. I want to believe. And that informs so much longing in society. As a English colleague said to me when we were discussing this very matter last month in Greece, following a conference that I and my dear friend and colleague Richard Dolan spoke at, I don't want to believe, I want to know. And I think all of us want to know the truth about this, and let's follow it and see where it goes.
Really good, Peter. Thanks for that. Just for those listeners who might not be aware of the story, the mummies of Nazca were presented by a Mexican ufologist who claims that they're 1,700 years old, and they have a reptilian look to them. A lot of people are very skeptical about this, as Peter said. There, if you put Nazca mummies online, you'll at least get what the tabloids have published about them. But don't spend too much time reading the tabloids. Read Peter Robbins and Peter's colleagues. Peter, these entities, these creatures, there's always a great debate and a great discussion about whether they are extraterrestrial or interdimensional, and what they might be trying to achieve with regards to the horrifying experiences that the abductions are, because they are dreadfully, dreadfully awful experiences, as you described yourself earlier on. And there are many examples on Peter's website, by the way, of the accounts of people who've experienced these things. What's going on, Peter? Extra dimensional, out there or in here somewhere? And what are they doing?
First, I want to apologize for how out of date my website is right now. We're working on updating it, but there is some information, interesting information on it at present. I will tell you, after 40 years of study, contemplation, research, meeting with these individuals, I am absolutely sure I don't really know. That's very frustrating to some folks.
No, it's not. It's brilliant.
You're an authority on this. You're supposed to know, and yeah, you're an expert. Well, I that word expert makes me cringe. How can we be an expert on something that is so phenomenally unknown? However, I have colleagues that I look to in this, people like Kathleen Martin, who has written several extraordinary books. She is actually the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, and has written several books with Stanton Friedman. She has also written a remarkable book on the abduction phenomena with another extraordinary abduction-focused researcher based in Florida named Denise Stoner, not as well known, but one of the best in the world. What I observe, first of all, is that we live in a cosmos that now even the most conservative astronomers begrudgingly acknowledge that there are tens of millions of exoplanets approximately the size of Earth, approximately the same distance from a star that is approximately the same size of the Sun. And if you are a person of faith, that gives you the potential of the miracle of life happening. If you are a pragmatist, it gives you the potential for the primordial ooze that bred the first one-celled character, a creature that resulted ultimately after billions of years in you and I, creatures with several more cells than they. I assume, again, by logical deduction and common sense, that of course some of these beings are extraterrestrial. However, it would be arrogant to suggest that's the end of the answer. We to say that they are not also representative of interdimensional beings who perhaps live right by our side, one dimension away, and who are hopefully enjoying this conversation we're having very much in your studio and in my office here, or from the center of the earth, or from wherever, is up for grabs. People who I've met and read their accounts and followed their work to a degree, who will tell you definitively things like, they're all from outer space and they're all good. Or, you know, these ones have been coming here for 487,000 years and they eat mice, glass, and dust, and these are the crafts that they come in and this is why they're here, are the people to back away from slowly, smiling, and get out of the room. To say that you know things that empirically, as far as I'm concerned, you cannot know, and maybe I'm showing my own limitations. I have people irregularly, you know, speak with me at conferences, sometimes after a talk. It might just be to say, I enjoyed your talk, I didn't enjoy your talk, or I know they're real and I know where they come from. Well, I always try to be respectful to people, and the natural question is, how do you know this? There's not a lot of answers. They can say, they told me, which for me is problematic. I learned it in a dream. I read it in a book. I saw it in a documentary. There are a lot more questions than answers here, Richie, and you know that's the way it is, and we struggle with them and do our best to sort it out. But I do believe that we are overwhelmingly likely dealing with quite an array of them, in quotes, from different origins who have different relationships with humanity. And it probably runs the gamut of the kinds of relationships we have with each other, from well-meaning and protective to, let's face it, we as a species have become the infestation on the host, and we are killing this planet with our overpopulation, with our toxification, with our not being good shepherds of where we live. This planet may have a special meaning to other intelligences who come and go with impunity and high technology, and they may not be very happy with what's happening here. That seems very likely to me. Again, do they want? I think the good news is if the worst news was true, we'd all be either dead or in the salt mines looking straight ahead and mining away and, you know, keeping a hive mentality. So something is in play, though. Something is in play. And it may well break open during our lifetimes. There is no question in my mind either.
That's really good, Peter. It's good you said that because there's a question on that. So I'm going to come to that in a second. The terrific Peter Robbins is on the line, folks. Thank you for the absolute deluge of tweets for Peter. Really good stuff. We'll be asking Peter back again in the autumn, and we'll do a full show with his blessing, of course. We'll get into this in greater depth. Peter, do you think it's possible? This is in no way a loaded question because I don't have a clue. By the way, I had a wonderful email today from a Jack Allen, no relation whatsoever. Jack is listening to this program in Edinburgh. And he said, the gist of the email was that Peter Robbins is infinitely listenable because he's one of the most humble guys out there. He always says he's got more questions than answers. That's a wonderful thing, that. It really is. A terrifically humble guy, Peter Robbins. On the line to us from Ithaca, New York State. Now, Peter, is it possible that some of these beings might be manipulating our reality? Had Rich Terrell from NASA on the program. Rich is now a subscriber to the simulation model, that our perception of reality is being manipulated. Is that an area of interest for you, Peter? How do you see that as a theory?
Well, it's a tremendous area of interest for me, and it should be for every human being on Earth. When you begin to seriously examine the absolutely outrageous and yet provable aspects of this phenomena, it's like entering a world of Pandora's boxes where you lift the lid and there's another 100 lids to contemplate. Like the very popular film, The Matrix, I don't know the answer to that. I am convinced, though, and this is in great part from having worked with Bud Hopkins for so many years and heard and investigated on a number of levels, hundreds of accounts, that one thing is certain in my mind is that they can manipulate our perceptions of them and of the world around us. I think there's also a wild card factor that many of my colleagues don't spend much time with. It's not as sexy or exotic as that. But that has to do with the physiology of human shock, something we have, most of us, have been through at one time in our lives or another, whether it's observing or being in a traffic accident, receiving a call out of the blue that somebody very dear to us has, you know, died very suddenly, or being in a situation that a normal person perceiving a absolutely non-standard situation like a UFO-related event might have. And that is that when you go into shock, you experience, among other things, auditory exclusion, tunnel vision, dumps of epinephrine and adrenaline into your bloodstream, and a level of denial that sometimes helps you survive what you're living through that seems impossible. I'll give you an example. A colleague of mine, Mike Cleland, a wonderful American author who published a very important book last year on the significance of owls to abductees and the lore and myth and accounts which exemplify that. I met Mike many years ago when he first started seeing Bud Hopkins as an abductee himself. And a claim that I've dealt with more than once through Bud and on my own is somebody who seems to be authentic and having this experience reports, among other things, that they viewed on their windowsill a 3 or 4 foot tall white owl. Well, the chances of that are next to nil. The chances that they're being manipulated and a screen memory is giving them something they can tolerate dealing with in that moment rather than an archetypical gray alien or being. I'm that word alien I've never been comfortable with. I usually refer to them as other intelligences. But in the physiology of human shock, that same kind of thing can protect us from the immediacy of something that we cannot deal with in that moment. So once again, it's a world of variables. Whether or not they can manipulate the reality around us, yes, I think they can to a degree. Certainly our realities. Beyond that, it's pure speculation.
Really good stuff, Peter. This is terrific stuff. We've only got 5 minutes left on this, and that comes to the last question, really. Let me just bring it up here again. Folks, check out Peter's website, peterrobbinsny.com. I know Peter said it's not been updated for a while. He's modest. There's a lot of terrific information on there and links to interviews that Peter has done and the blog and everything. Get on there, peterrobbinsny.com. A really good friend of mine listening in Dublin, Jean-Ann Crowley, great actress, great Irish woman, says, Richie, ask Peter, does he think the USA is heading for disclosure in the not-too-distant future? And if so, why? Because some people obviously know. And that, of course, touches on what you said a few minutes ago, Peter. I do remember you saying to me a few minutes ago, you think we might know a lot more in our lifetime. Are we heading for disclosure? We've got 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah. I regret for the dear questioner in Dublin that will be the case unless the hand of the United States government is truly forced. Of all the world governments, and the phenomena officially kicks in here 70 years ago this summer, the American government has categorically been the least forthcoming of any world government on this subject. They live in a world of denial, in part because the initial repression of the information kicked in this summer 70 years ago. It's brilliantly defined in a number of pieces of writings. For me, I would point to the scholarly works of Richard Dolan, Part 1 and Part 2 of UFOs and the National Security State, as a great place to look. Let's face it, if Harry Truman, who was president at the time, had come forward and said in what would have been a history-changing moment, to put it mildly, my fellow Americans and citizens of the world, it's my solemn duty to inform you that we are not alone in the universe, and here's how we know this. Everything would have changed in 1947. My gut feeling is that his advisors advised him against it, in part because they love being advisors, the most critical issue in the history of humanity. And that piece of sand that the pearl grew up around, that became the seed of our entire national security world, has to do with repression of this subject. If an American public, president, left or right, conservative, Republican, if it had been Obama, if it would be Trump, were to come forward and start to say the same thing, first they couldn't. This would now have to be done in total coordination with other world leaders, learning institutions, religious leaders, the world of scientists, astronomers, psychologists, etc. But if he could, if the President of the United States came forward and said, we've been repressing this since 1947, they would have to admit, by extension, that every single American president, left, right, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, has been an unindicted co-conspirator in the greatest cover-up in history. And this is a club. It doesn't matter, ultimately, what party you're with or what your leanings are. And when you look at our distinguished world of ex-presidents who every once in a while pose photos together, life is good for these guys. And they're not going to betray each other. They're not going to betray their compatriots that came before them. I fear that disclosure per se will not be coming from the United States government.
Peter, just before we go, my fiance had a bar in Spain some years ago, and a gentleman came in a few nights with his wife. He was an Irishman. He was in his mid-70s. And he spent 40 years as an Aer Lingus captain. And for 25 of those years, he was flying the Atlantic route. So he was flying into O'Hare, into JFK, you know, all the big eastern seaboard airports a lot of the time. We're having a chat anyway, and I said to him one evening, I said, don't take the mickey out of me, don't take the piss, as we say in Ireland, but did you see stuff up there? And he said, we saw some strange stuff, all right. I said, give us an example. And he said, I will. He said, but I will tell you, he said, that we never spoke about these things. There was a policy of you never ever spoke, or you never told your superiors if you saw anything. But he said, we were halfway across the Atlantic, he said, one evening. And just off, I don't know whether he said starboard, but he said just off in front of us was this massive, what looked like shotgun pellet, like a big ball bearing, a big steel thing. And I said, in the sky? And he said, yeah. I said, how big was it? And he said, it was monstrous.
Yes.
And I said, and what? And he said, it started moving up and down. And then eventually he said it shot off up into the sky. We couldn't see it. But he said it was huge, a big steel ball that had no business being there. And I knew he was telling the truth, Peter. I knew he wasn't having me on. And I said, you never spoke to anybody. And he said, there was two other guys in the cockpit, me and the two other guys, co-pilot and the third officer, or whatever he was. And we just looked at one another and we said, well, that's just another thing we won't be talking about ever again.
Yeah. Richie, it's endemic in that career, among other careers. It will destroy your career as a commercial airline pilot. It goes back to the 1940s. The fear of ridicule is absolutely corrosive, and it still exists. It gets a little better every year, but I don't blame him. It would be very reckless to come forward in that career.
Peter, do you know what? It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. We've just been listening to Peter Robbins, folks, for the best part of the last hour. Go to Peter's website, peterrobbinsny.com. I've tweeted that out already. Follow Peter, read the blogs, listen to the interviews that he's done. Loads of YouTube videos of Peter speaking. Incredibly interesting, insightful stuff, it really is. Thanks for doing it, Peter. And with your permission, come back on this programme for a longer stint in the early autumn. I'd be honoured to have you back.
Richie, I not only will be honored to come back in the early autumn, I'll be honored to come back on a semi-regular basis. I have so enjoyed our chat. I wish there were more radio hosts out there like you. Thank you for letting me be on your show and speak to your audience, and all the best to all of you. And again, keep up the good work. We need more people like you in the media.
There'll always be a platform for people like you, Peter. Thanks so much for doing it. Enjoy the rest of the day there in Ithaca, New York. Pleasure. Thank you, Peter. The great Peter Robbins, live on the line there from New York State. Terrific stuff. Follow the website, peterrobbinsny.com. We'll be inviting Peter back on this program again real soon. Terrific to have him on. That's about it for the programme. We're right out of time. Thanks for listening to it. Big shout to George Galloway for the first hour, and for Peter Robbins, who joined us there this hour. Loads of questions came in there. I got through most of them in the course of the conversation, naturally, anyway. For the ones I didn't get to, we will get Peter on again, as I said, in the autumn, and we'll put those questions to him. Great to have Simon Stewart back working on the YouTube channel. Thanks, Simon. And a big shout out to Aaron Calland, who's currently rebuilding the Richie Allen website, richieallen.co.uk. This programme was edited, introduced and produced by myself, Richie Allen. You and I will chat again tomorrow at 7 p.m. BST for Tuesday's programme. Until then, look after yourselves and one another. The podcast of this will be online in around about 15 minutes' time. Going to leave you with some Neil Diamond. This is one of my favourite songs of all time. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Ellie's fine, the sun shines most of the time, and the feeling is laid back. Palm trees grow and rents are low, but you know, keep thinking about making my way back. Well, I'm New York City born and raised, but nowadays I'm lost between two shores. LA's fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more. I am myself to no one there, and no one heard at all, not even the chair. I am my cry. Did you ever read about a frog who dreamed of being a king and then became one? Well, except for